From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. After taping this topic on surveillance and considering the relevance to our many recent news stories revolving around the NSA, I decided to break the program into part one this evening and part two next Tuesday. Many of you have listened to the longer version podcasts of our programs in the past, and I'll post this one too as a long version. I think, however, that for those of you who will not be able to use the podcast, as well as those who are following this topic of surveillance in the news, airing the entire discussion really is worthwhile. I hope you enjoy part one this evening and come back next week for part two. Just as our generations develop and evolve, so too this topic gets more and more involved as we work through the taping.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. Glad you guys can join us here this afternoon on what I think is going to be a very lively discussion about a very hot topic in the news today. And before we get into that, I do want to remind you that if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, you can catch the podcast version on KUAR at KUAR.org. You just have to click on Programs, go all the way to the very end, under Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, and you'll find our link there to this particular program. Also, we're on iTunes if you're into that at all. Our topic here today, surveillance. And as I was thinking about this topic over the last few weeks coming up, and in fact, all of you listening today probably have been somewhere today, even if you're not right now, someplace where you have been under surveillance of some sort anyway. And it's really not like the old days where you watch the gangster movie or the cop movie where they're sitting in the car watching across the street or watching two flights up. Surveillance means entirely different things today than it did before. And that's what we want to talk today about from our generational perspectives. My three guests with me here today, joining me here in the studio, speaking from the older generation, is Dr. Art English. He's been on the program several times before. He's a distinguished professor emeritus in political science here at UALR. Dr. English, glad to have you back again.
Nice to be here, Phil.
And then also in the studio with me here, speaking from the younger generation perspective, a name you've heard quite often in the last several months around the Little Rock area anyway, Adam Lansky. He's speaking from that younger generation, and he's been one of the central figures in the Occupy movement here in Arkansas, and he's had some special experiences with surveillance from that movement's activities, too. Adam, glad to have you with us
thank
here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Phil.
And then joining us from Arlington, Virginia, is Jay Stanley. He's speaking from that middle generation perspective. He's a senior policy analyst with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, and I've read several of his blog items that he's put on the ACLU site. He's written extensively about the issues of surveillance. Jay Stanley, so glad to have you joining us here in Little Rock today.
Thanks for having me on.
Dr. English, I want to start with you because you and I are sort of close to the same age anyway. You're just a tad older than me anyway. In fact, before we went on the air, we were commenting about the fact that from our standpoint, surveillance really is kind of a tough thing to think about because it really is something that's kind of come on. Take us back a little bit to what your perspectives are on surveillance.
Yeah, well, Phil, that's true. Interesting topic. You're right. I don't think I have a modern generation perspective on this. Of course, you know, I read pretty extensively the newspapers, and I don't keep up too much with the blogs and things of that sort. But I do have some, you know, interesting experiences and, you know, certainly just, you know, living these past 30 or 40 years, you know, while I've been, you know, teaching and interacting, you know, with the political system. I brought a couple of things with me when I was thinking about this. I went to my library and I fished out a book I've had for a long time, and it was called I Led Three Lives. It was actually a very well-known television program series during the 50s and 60s. It involved a fellow by the name of Herb Philbrick. And I thought that was an interesting part, you know, of the surveillance question. It's still going on in the sense that we have that kind of surveillance taking place. But basically, it was the idea of the FBI planting people in the Communist Party, which was viewed as a very substantial threat during the 1940s and the 50s. And in this particular instance, Herb Philbrick, I believe he was a pharmacist or something like that. He had a white-collar occupation, but by night he was in communist cells. That's how the FBI got its information, and enough information, as a matter of fact, as Philbrick relates in the early part of the book, He says, when I walked into the House Un-American Activities Committee investigation of these communists, including Eugene Dennis, and it was a very famous constitutional law case, Dennis versus the United States, which I believe resulted in the conviction of these 11 communists, I believe, under the Smith Act. That is kind of, you know, the reflection that I had about it. If you look at that, that's how intelligence agencies, surveillance agencies like the FBI, primarily a domestic surveillance agency, but they certainly do have, especially these days with terrorism, foreign responsibilities also. So I thought that was kind of an interesting place to start, and it certainly does date me, but that was one of the things that struck me.
Is there a particular time when surveillance even came into your lexicon? Was it ever even talked about up until a certain point?
Absolutely. I think when I was in graduate school, there was a lot of anti-Vietnam activity taking place on the campus that I was. There were people that were concerned that they were being watched by the FBI. I think there was probably good reason for that. I think there was just a book recently out. It's about the FBI working with Ronald Reagan and working with people in the Screen Actors Guild, of which Reagan was a member, to actually force Clark Kerr, who was then, I believe, the president of UCLA, I think. And there was a particular individual by the name of Mario Savio, and I hadn't thought about him in a long time. But long story short, he was a charismatic radical. There were people in the administration who were worried about him. Herbert Hoover at that time was the director of the FBI. And he worked particularly with Reagan, who thought that Kerr was not tough enough on these radicals, interestingly enough. And actually, I think at one point forced Kerr out, curried favor with Hoover and the administration and Nixon at that time. That was very beneficial to him politically later on. So there's some that was kind of the context that I people would sort of comment, you know, sort of droll. They would drolly comment like, you know, you better look around. There may be some FBI agents here tonight.
It was mainly strictly FBI. Wasn't any other group or anything.
Might have been. I have some experience with the CIA, too. I think I'll talk about that a little later.
Okay.
But it's a very interesting perspective I have on the CIA, simply because of the fact that I was a grader in graduate school to a very fine man who was formerly the executive director of the CIA in his Cold War operations courses and in his national security course. I remember that fondly. I still think I have the note. He's now deceased, but we can talk about that a little later.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me jump to Jay Stanley here. Jay, from your perspective, I know you've been heavily involved with the aspects from as it pertains to the ACLU, but what does surveillance mean to somebody your age?
Well, it means being watched when I don't know that I'm being watched. I mean, obviously, everybody is watched sometimes. If you walk down the sidewalk, you know that the people that you can see can also see you. But when there's people that I can't see that see me, or people I'm not talking to who are hearing what I'm saying, then that is a form of power over me. And we're seeing that, you know, obviously in the government context where it's been in the news so much because of Edward Snowden. But it's also happening in the commercial context where, you know, the internet industry is building basically a vast machine for keeping track of what everybody does online and learning as much as they can about everybody. But I mean, it really means it's not something that helps me in any way. If it does help me, then I can choose, you know, perhaps to opt into it and to make a conscious decision or a trade to give away information about myself or about my activities in exchange for some sort of benefit. But when I don't know that it's happening, I haven't given permission for it, that surveillance doesn't help me. It helps somebody else. It shifts power away from me and towards somebody else.
One of the things I read that you were talking about was in comparison to the military industrial complex. You wrote a little bit about the surveillance industrial complex, I guess. And I think that's sort of what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I wrote a report, called the Surveillance Industrial Complex that looks at, you know, how government information collection and surveillance and the private sector information collection and surveillance, and both do it for their own reasons, but in many ways they dovetail. In East Germany, you had the secret police called the Stasi, which kept very, very detailed records on everybody and got people to report on each other and everything and built up giant dossiers on everybody, even when there was no reason to suspect that they were involved in wrongdoing. So I guess there's two things. Number one, we are seeing, for the very first time, we're seeing the construction of secret police agencies in the United States. The NYPD carried out an extensive program of infiltrating mosques and other visiting shops and everything because of the ethnicity of the people who own them. And that creates a deep sense of suspicion and unease when people don't know whether somebody who's around them, one of their peers, one of their friends, one of their acquaintances, might be reporting back to a government agency. And so that there's that side of it. But on the other FBI, we have private companies that, for not for political reasons like the Stasi or the FBI, but for purely commercial reasons, are basically doing what the Stasi did and building giant dossiers with as much information as they can about as many people as they can. And these are companies that brag that they have 400 million files and 400 million people with 30 or 60 data points on all of us. Congress passed laws after the abuses during the Cold War and the Vietnam Civil Rights era that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover engaged in, that, you know, that basically ban the FBI from keeping files on people if they're not involved in any kind of criminal wrongdoing or suspicion. But these companies are keeping files, and the FBI can make a contract with these companies, which it has, and so the companies keep the files, and the FBI can access them. So in some ways, it's an end run around the laws and around the Constitution. And that's part of what I was getting at with this surveillance industrial complex, how the private sector and the government sort of how their efforts often mesh with each other.
Now, also, from your perspective, your age group, is surveillance something that's on people's mind in your age and Dr. English's time and my time particularly? It really didn't really come to our forefront for a while as an important issue. But is it an issue thing for people your age?
I think that there's always a bell curve. Polling shows that some people are very, very concerned about privacy and sort of as a matter of principle are fiercely protective of their privacy and want public policies to protect it. Other people worry about it when it hits them in the face, and other people say they don't really care about it at all, although usually those people care too when it does hit them in the face. I think there's a political dimension to it. People who have libertarian political beliefs or are on the left and have experienced either directly or have heard about how security agencies have been, whose job in police agencies, it's not just, you know, the FBI historically, but it was also police departments and creating intelligence units and infiltrating groups, even though they have no evidence that they're involved in or planning any kind of wrongdoing, but just because of their political beliefs, something that an abuse we've seen repeatedly for over a century. That is something that we've seen, unfortunately, and we need to take some steps to ensure that these kinds of abuses can't keep happening.
Well, let me bring Adam Lansky into our conversation now from that younger generation. Let me start with you, Adam, kind of where I've left off with Jay Stanley and Dr. English. Is surveillance important to people your age? And if so, how important?
So when I answer this question, I'd like to sort of answer it from my perspective and then from my generation's perspective,
sure.
My perspective of my generation's perspective,
right.
If that's okay. So for me personally, the first thing I want to point out, which to me is really the crux of the issue, is Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, okay? I'm talking about the presidential oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will do the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, okay? So here we have, again, this is my angle. We have a president who is sworn into oath and in 2008 swears up and down he's going to turn this whole boat around, and now come to 2013, my generation is looking on YouTube at videos of Obama 2008 versus Obama 2013. Okay, and what we're seeing are two completely different pictures. He's gone 180 degrees around from what he said he was going to do. So that's just a little bit of insight to, first of all, my generation's faith in our political system and our political system's ability to serve its constituents, okay? Older generations have witnessed the change. My generation and younger have mostly been conditioned to expect it and believe that if you aren't doing anything wrong, then you have nothing to fear. But again, regardless of my personal conduct, the fact of the matter is that unwarranted surveillance is illegal and there's no oversight for these activities. I would venture to say that the majority of my generation doesn't even understand our rights as Americans. There is a growing number of young people that are beginning to connect the dots, but the biggest issue of my generation is that we are so inundated with an infinite variety of material, mindless distractions that apathy is really the enemy here. What really complicates matters as well, and I hope this doesn't feel like a tangent because to me it's all very closely related, is that acute narcissism is a really widespread attitude, and that many young people actually desire to have their personal information publicly broadcast. My generation of people younger, we want to be out in the open. We want to be on Facebook. We want you to know what we're eating for breakfast. We want you to know when we're in the bathroom and what's going on in there, okay? And I think partly it's because of role models. That's a whole other chapter of discussion that perhaps we'll get into, role models in the media, you know. In my generation's defense regarding Facebook, when it comes to social networking sites like Facebook, MySpace, there are privacy controls, and certain data is you can set as private, which should be hidden from public view. Now, in this case, we do have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, I'm talking about Katz versus United States. I'm going back to 1967 here. Dr. English is nodding. He knows exactly what I'm talking about, right? If you ask my generation what's Katz versus the United States, they probably think it's a hip-hop battle. You know, they think it's a hip-hop rap battle.
Why does your generation not know that?
They haven't taken my constitutional law course.
Thank you, sir. No, that's right. They haven't. And I'll tell you why. Who controls the media controls perception of reality, thereby controls opinion, thereby controls direction, controls the world, etc. Okay, so I had a conversation with a friend of mine on the way here. You know, I tell him I'm coming to this to have this discussion with you guys. And what he says is two things. He says, number one, we are a generation now. Again, this isn't necessarily me. This is my perspective on my generation. We have become a generation where so much of the thinking is done for us, where we don't have to think about what am I going to get food now? You know, what do I go to next in life? The path is all really sort of set for you. The decisions are all pre-made, and we just have to act it out. Okay, but the second thing also, and this goes back to what I was sort of talking about, briefly touched on with role models, is, you know, when you're turning on the TV and you're seeing, you know, the big hullabaloo about, oh, Miley Cyrus is getting involved in the Video Music Awards, you know, or this guy, Edward Snowden, is a traitor and he's, you know, extradited from the country now. He can't come back in without going to prison. It's like, it becomes a lot more difficult to see through the smokescreen and understand what is really important and why are these things important. Why is being surveilled on even a threat to me? You know, because it's not an immediate threat. We don't have – my generation doesn't have this instinctual reaction to it like you do, Dr. English, or anyone else in this conversation for that matter, you know, where we might feel my privacy is – my security is my privacy. My privacy is my security. We don't have that instinct is gone. And I really would say a lot of it is because of the media, because the reality TV has been so glamorized. And now there is, like I said, what was it exactly? I said an infinite variety of mindless material distractions from reality. And it becomes very difficult to sort out what is important and what is truth, what is fiction, what is the Constitution.
Well, Jay Stanley, let me let you back into the conversation. Does any of this fit into your bailiwick of the writings that you've been talking about?
Yeah, I think that, you know, certainly there's differences between the generations, but I think that there's often a tendency to say, oh, young people today don't care about their privacy as much as older people, but I'm not actually sure that that's true because, I mean, there are different things going on. I mean, a lot of the polling shows some minor differences between younger and older people, but I think that a lot of people have the impression that younger people don't, first of all, a lot of older people don't really care about privacy. I mean, privacy is an issue, and most people are busy, and they're trying to get through their lives, and they don't have time to think about any issues in that much depth. You know, I think that there are young people who are very politicized and are very focused on this, and there are older people who are, and there are some on both sides. I mean, young people, of course, are the social media generation. So young people are using social media more than older people. And social media is just kind of tricky from a privacy point of view. It tends to mess up your privacy intuitions. You think that you're talking to one audience when you're actually talking to a wider audience. And, you know, so young people often post things on social media, you know, in ways that maybe aren't that smart for their privacy, but older people do too. I mean, there's plenty of older people who've gotten embarrassed by things that they've put on Facebook. You know, sometimes the differences are exaggerated.
Dr. English, you and I know I heard from my mom, I don't know how many times when I was growing up, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't need to worry about it. Why would you worry about being under surveillance if you're not doing anything wrong? Words to that effect. Have you heard a lot of that too, or is that something that is an attitude of an older generation too?
Well, of course, I've heard the line and, you know, a lot, and a lot of people believe that. I think it might cut across generations in a sense that we're probably not as aware of our expectation of reasonable privacy as we perhaps should be. But part of that is because the political environment has changed. I think people are more willing to perhaps at least not think about that too seriously because they view the threat of national security, terrorism, and attacks on their well-being outweighing what they might give up in terms of being surveilled, so to speak. And part of that, I think, is because it used to be a simpler game, I think, during the 50s and 60s. There were communists. Yeah. There were spies representing nation states. But now what we have is a collection of individuals, you know, people who threaten our security may come out of nowhere, as it did in the Boston Marathon. You know, who would have thought that that would have happened there and by those particular individuals?
Do you think there was as much industrial surveillance or even personal surveillance like in towns and that sort of thing?
I don't know empirically, but I don't believe so. You know, Jay could answer that more than I can. But, of course, I do know that it has increased substantially, I mean, in terms of cameras everywhere. I think England, particularly, mm-hmm. interestingly enough, has been a country which has had tremendous amounts of cameras and surveillance, you know, there. And so, you know, when you are walking someplace, when you're jogging someplace or so forth, you're under scrutiny. And that is kind of weird for the, you know, the 1984 Orwellian generation that I was part of.
Did you ever think that would be a reality when that first came out?
No, not to this degree. You know, 1984 came and went, and it, you know, when I was reading that book, it was when I was in high school, and it was the late 50s or early 60s or something like that, you know, and I said, "Mine, 1984, that's a long way away." And now it came and went. And
now it's a long way back, isn't
now
it?
Now it's 30 years in arrears and so forth. I'll tell you why I think it's a concern. Because we have to remember, it's not just the cameras, it's not just the drones, it's not just the data files, it's the people who are managing these and amassing this data. If those people do not adhere to democratic norms, as the younger generation individual here, Mr. Lansky, was talking about, he was talking about the Constitution. If they don't really, you know, respect the idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy, the idea of First Amendment freedoms, your Bill of Rights, and things like that. If that somehow grows dim in the arrears of history, so to speak, of their general, you know, I don't know what would happen at that particular point. I mean, you know,
that's today.
Yeah, bad things can happen to people because bad people are making them happen, and so that is a concern for me about all of this. And I don't think people think about it an awful lot because, I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, you know, for example, the 9/11 attacks. I mean, that launched the tremendous national security complex. You know, if you look today, I think the black budget is out about how much our intelligence agencies spend, and primarily anti-terrorism, surveillance, and things like that. It's in very technologically innovative areas in terms of collections of data, over $50 billion. And I think I just heard that the CIA, which is kind of interesting, as I said, that was primarily interested in nation states surveillance and spies and things like that. At least that was my understanding. And I actually, as I said, I actually was a grader to one of these individuals who I think had a great respect for democracy. And if I could just take a minute, let me just read a passage from this because I thought it was very interesting. This book is called The Real CIA. It's by Lyman Kirkpatrick Jr., and he was the executive director of the CIA. That is not the top position, but it's like the second or third position in the CIA. And on page 4 of this book, which was published, I believe, in 1968, 1969, he says, "The American people have a deep concern, indeed fear, over the concentration of too much power in any area of our society. When this power is in the government and cloaked in secrecy, then their concern is even greater. This is an inheritance from our colonial days and from the waves of immigrants fleeing oppression, first monarchical and then dictatorial, both fascist and communist, in Europe. It is not a concern about secrecy as such, which the people will accept as a necessity for national security, nor is it a concern about intelligence activity, which the public recognizes as a necessary government function during a period of international tension and strife." And here's his point, I think. "It is a concern about secret power and the possibilities of its abuse." And I think, you know, I thought that was pretty interesting going back and reading this thing that came out in 1969 mm-hmm. and by a person who was the executive director until he left to take a university position at an Ivy League university.
Well, Jay Stanley, is that the kind of the crux of the work that you've been involved with in talking about surveillance?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think it was Madison or one of our founding fathers said, you know, if men were angels, we wouldn't need checks and balances. You know, I think that surveillance in some ways has changed, in other ways it hasn't. I mean, I think we've always seen surveillance abused, investigating people because of their beliefs. without any evidence that they're actually planning to violate the law. But we also, you know, and the people have lived in small towns where everybody watches each other and sees each other, and then there's a police officer who walks up and down the street and sees everybody. But now we're reaching the point where technology has got to the point where we can all be watched all the time, as if we had our own personal police officer following us around 24/7, which I think would freak most people out. And the technology is here to collect information on everybody and to store records of what everybody does all the time. And we as a country have to decide, do we want to go down that road? Do we want to allow the government that amount of power to allow them to keep records of everywhere you've driven? And police departments, we did a big study about this, and police departments around the country, for example, are installing license plate readers, which automatically take pictures of license plates that drive by. They can do like thousands of license plates an hour, and you know, to check for stolen cars and everything. We don't have a problem with that, but if the car isn't stolen and there's no flag, they still retain the data, so they know that you drove your car on this block at this time. And if they, you know, we're rapidly getting to the point where we're going to have these readers on every block, and they'll be able to punch in your license plate number and know everywhere that you've been for the last 3 years, which is a tremendously revealing amount of information about your life. It can reveal where you worship and what political groups you might visit, or union activities, or what doctors you visit and what their specialties are, who your friends and lovers are, you know, anything that's going on in your life. Location information will reveal that. And at the same time that we have this powerful technology, whether it's license plate scanning or cell phone tracking or internet tracking that reveals so much about us, we have this giant national security establishment, which has been revealed today in the Washington Post, just the dimensions of it, which is a very powerful bureaucratic force, which is pushing to collect more and more information about more and more people. And, you know, we have some big decisions to make as a country, whether we want to allow our government to have that amount of power using these new technologies.
Hope you've enjoyed part one of our discussion on surveillance. Next Tuesday at 7, we'll conclude with part two of our generational discussion with these same guests.
Well, folks, we've been talking about surveillance today, a very, very serious subject, and I'm glad to have been able to cover it in the way we have here. I hope you've enjoyed it. I know it's been probably on your mind even as you've gone through your day-to-day activities, wondering whether or not you have been surveilled on in any way, shape, or form. My guest has been with me here today, speaking from that older generation, a guest we've had on many times, Dr. Art English. He's a professor emeritus of political science here at UALR. Dr. English, glad to have had you back with me here again today.
Thanks very much, Bill.
And then also in the studio has been Adam Lansky. He's has been one of the central figures in the Occupy movement here in Arkansas and has a bright future, I think, ahead in staying as an activist. Adam, thanks for being with us here today.
It's been a big honor, Phil, and thanks to everyone else for talking. It was so cool hanging with you guys.
And then from Arlington, Virginia, Jay Stanley is a senior policy analyst with the ACLU, and you can follow him if you want to go to his website, which I believe is aclu.org, isn't it, Jay?
Yes, and I added a blog called Free Future, which focuses on these surveillance technology issues.
Right, and I went through several of them there, and in fact, there's many, many, many of them, all of them very well written. And if you're at all interested in this topic of surveillance, you'd like to learn a little bit more, you can catch his site there. Jay, thanks for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, again, folks, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, you'll find it at KUAR.org. You're listening tonight to just the half-hour version, but we've got about an hour here that we've been talking, so there's a lot more that you'll find there. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.